living more and more of our lives on our screens. We manage our bank accounts and investments. We plan our vacations. We talk to our loved ones on social media from our computers or our smartphones. But as our digital footprint grows, so do the risks. I'm Oscar Lynn Elder, Co-Chief Investment Officer for Truist Wealth. And this is I've Been Meaning to Do That, a podcast from Truist Wealth, a purpose-driven financial services organization. We appreciate you listening. Wealthy individuals and families are an attractive target for hackers. A breach can affect not just your financial situation, but also your privacy, reputation, and peace of mind. Today, we're tackling an urgent topic in the field of wealth management, cybersecurity. And I'm talking with an expert from the front lines, Charlotte Edwards, who is Vice President of Operations at CyberWolf. CyberWolf specializes in cybersecurity for business leaders, wealthy families, and others with a heightened need for protection. CyberWolf is a referral partner of Truist Financial Corporation. Charlotte, thank you for joining me on I've Been Meaning to Do That.
Thank you, Oscar Lynn. I am beyond thrilled to be on the podcast. Super excited to have this conversation about personal cybersecurity for leaders, individuals, and families.
Let's start by introducing CyberWolf. What sets your company apart in the world of cybersecurity, and who do you serve?
CyberWolf's mission is to protect the online lives of high net worth individuals and their families. So we often work with company leaders, board members, athletes, wealthy families, typically indeed people who need that heightened protection. The best way to describe us is like having a digital bodyguard.
Wonderful. That vision of a digital bodyguard. Before we get further in our discussion, you've got a really interesting background yourself with experience, I believe, in both technology as well as the legal world.
So I did not really take the traditional path into cybersecurity. We see that a lot of people in cybersecurity either have a background in the army or in the government. So in my specific case, I actually graduated in international criminal law. So it was my dream to become a criminal lawyer. I did start with an internship, but I very quickly realized once I dipped my toes into the professional world, I loved the studies, but the job itself just wasn't a match for me. So I pivoted into business. So after that, I did an additional year at business school. It was a great experience. And at some point, my paths crossed with CyberWolf. And I immediately fell in love with its mission. It's not just about protecting the people. It's also making sure that they feel trusted and that they feel safe with you. So the focus and the impact of it is what really drew me into CyberWolf and into cybersecurity.
What I hear really clearly is that you really have passion and purpose connected with the work that you're doing day in and day out that comes through. We all have a digital presence now. I think pretty much everybody has to have some form of a digital presence. And cybersecurity is definitely an issue that touches us all at some point. I think I received another scam text this weekend, truly, asking me to pay a toll that was non-existent. And I suspect most of our listeners have gotten those scammer type of text in the last few weeks. Right. So it definitely touches us all. But why is cybersecurity such a critical issue, especially for high net worth individuals and families in particular?
I touched upon it just before. You are statistically more likely to be scammed online than you are to experience a physical burglary. And there's actually a very nice parallel that you can draw between both of them. If you would think about a physical burglary, people just know that there is more to gain from high net worth individuals. If a burglar has a choice between a mansion or a villa versus an average home or an apartment, they will go for the first option just because they know that there is more for them to gain. But why is it becoming so critical and is it so much needed? Is because the stakes are just so much higher for those families. And of course, the first place our mind goes to is there's a lot more to gain financially. But it goes a lot further than that. Reputation is a second big part of it. So a name carries fame. We see that personal details are often something that can be sold online. Hackers or bad actors, they try to impersonate a person. Or for example, in a very extreme example, personal details can be sold to tabloids. But a reputation can have far-fetched consequences as well, in the sense that if a reputation becomes tarnished, it can actually ruin a family business. And it's also something that can carry on across generations. And so it's not just about the individual, it's also about the family, because from a hacker's perspective, there are so many different ways in. And we often see hackers targeting family members. So we actually had an example of a wealthy individual who is an active investor, and they did not target the investor. They actually targeted the spouse of the investor who was doing furniture shopping online for their second or their third home that they were building. And they had access to her mailbox. They were actually lurking in her mailbox for multiple weeks. And they saw that she was doing that furniture shopping. And at some point, they sent a fake invoice to her email account from a company that she was doing online shopping with. And that invoice was paid without second guessing. So this is an example of, it's not always necessarily that one person or the investor or the breadwinner within the family. It's often people who are very close to them, who are connected to them.
These hackers are creative, and your company is aware of how the creativity is shifting over time. Can you give us some idea about how CyberWolf is protecting its clients from attack? And how does CyberWolf respond if there is an incident?
So from a protection point of view, for CyberWolf, it's all about a combination. You need to have, on one hand, the technology, the actual security tools to protect you. But then there's a very human component to it as well. You have to make sure that there is someone, a team that has their backs, giving them peace of mind, and that they can also call in times of need. We very often see that when there is an incident, that there is a lot of shame. At that moment, they do need somebody that they can trust and they can tell their story to. I actually very recently only discovered that a very close friend of mine had paid their electricity bill with Bitcoin, which obviously was a scam, but he told me it was something that he did 2 or 3 years ago, but only now he told it, because in hindsight, he said, how could I have been so stupid to ever pay my electricity bill in Bitcoin? For the technology part of it, which was the first point, we always look at it from an all-in perspective. And you can actually, again, compare it very easily with a house. When you think about your own house and when you think about the protective measures that you take for your own house, you go all in. You will think about multiple layers of protection. You will lock your doors. You will fence your house. You will get a dog. You might have a vault to put in your valuables. Because you think if one of those layers potentially falters, you still have other layers set in place. So it's very similar for us. And when we think about cybersecurity, where we combine multiple tools, multiple layers to protect everything that you do online, because there's a lot that you do online. You surf online, you send emails, you receive emails, you download applications, you fill out online forms. So why would you only think about security as kind of, I only need to protect my email, I only need to protect my device? You have to think about it holistically, in a very comprehensive way.
Can you give us a high level about what happens if there is an incident?
Yes. Our ultimate goal is to make sure that nothing happens. But if indeed there is an incident, we either get notified by one of our tools, or it's one of our analysts that does proactive searching of any anomalies. You have to imagine it as almost an alarm bell going off. And then there is a dedicated team that we actually bring in, and they do what we call incident response. So they are trained for very specific situations, and they will fully resolve the incident step by step. And what we typically see as well, because every incident is different, it depends on what was compromised, how it was compromised. So that's very unique in its sense. But what we see is crucial across all incidents is actually the communication part of it, making sure that we are very transparent and very open with the people that we work with in, this is what we found. These are the next steps that we're going to take. And it also brings a sense of trust that they are also very open to us, because sometimes they might have done something that they should not have been doing, but it helps us to resolve an incident.
Yeah, I'm going to draw a parallel between what you've just shared with us and what we often talk about on our podcast is the importance of pivotal moments and preparing for pivotal moments. We know these moments are going to happen in life. It's far better when people prepare for these pivotal moments, because there are hackers out there who are likely to come after you if you're a high net worth individual or family.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. It will happen. And it is indeed one of those pivotal moments that you should prepare for, because it is almost naive to think that it will never happen to you, because I'm 100% sure every person has already received an attack, but it might not be as sophisticated as we typically see as well.
Are there any common misconceptions that people have about cybersecurity? I imagine that sometimes people don't understand the stakes until something goes wrong.
So there's three misconceptions I'd like to double click on and also make one additional small side note. So in terms of the first misconception, we typically say you are a 360 target. So what do we mean with that? It means that all aspects of your life are considered when an attack is being planned. A very concrete example, we had an executive of a very large corporation and they had a Strava account. So they are a big cyclist and they had a very specific bike. And on the Strava account, there were multiple pictures of this individual with the bike, with a lot of zoom-in pictures as well, where you could even see the serial number of the bike. And at some point during one of the trips, he had put on the Strava account that the bike broke down and that it was a very specific part that was missing, which if you are a hacker at that point, that's actually the perfect setup. If you have been waiting for multiple weeks and months to impersonate as a bike shop, do a proposal for that very specific bike part that they are looking for, because you have the serial number, you have everything. So it's a very concrete example of they look at you as a holistic person. Second misconception is a typical saying here is the buck stops with me. In cybersecurity, we say the buck doesn't stop with you. So it's not because you as an individual have very good reflections on cybersecurity and you're very meticulous on how you behave online that other people are the same as you. So imagine that you have a hacker and they want to target the CEO of a company, and that CEO might be the mother or the father of a household. They won't necessarily look at just that CEO, but they will look at the family, at the loved ones, at friends, at the whole network around them who will help them create that credible context and who they could potentially manipulate in a situation. And then the third part is the level of sophistication. We all know the toll scams. Recently, I've been receiving a lot about recruiting. So a lot of companies are trying to recruit me, allegedly. So a lot of people underestimate the sophistication as well of those attacks. What we typically see is not the toll text messages or the long lost family relative of a prince or a princess, but these are people that take the time to get to know you very well. They do a lot of preparation and they wait for the right moment to carry out that attack. Those people, they have time. So I gave you the example of the furniture shopping. And we also, for example, often see that scams or hacks happen the moment that there is a bank transfer. So again, those people wait until they know that you will do a big transfer of money, and the attacks that are crafted for those people are focused only on you.
It just strikes me what you were talking about are when we start dealing with ultra high net worth individuals and families, hackers move from blanket attacks to very bespoke, customized attack. And if someone is tired or rushing, moving from point A to point B quickly, it's easy to understand if it's highly orchestrated and bespoke and customized, it's easy to be victim to the hacker in that situation, especially. So to sum up, there are definitely hackers out there and they like to target people with money. That's part of what we've learned from you, Charlotte. Fortunately, there are also ways that we can protect ourselves from them. And so coming up next, we'll talk about how cyber criminals think and plan their attacks and what it means for defending ourselves. Charlotte, you've had a chance to see and to study a lot of incidents. What have you learned about how hackers identify and select their targets? And how does it differ from those who are targeting wealthy or influential people specifically, as opposed to more blanket attacks.
A lot of people have what we call the "don't me" syndrome, and they think that they would never be a target. We actually see that everybody is a target. Every single person has received an attack, but the sophistication of it indeed is very different. So we have low-level amateurs who do blast mass messaging to thousands of people. But we also see a lot of professionals who actually do what we call whale hunting. In those cases, we're talking about organized ransomware groups who cripple big corporations. We're talking about very structured organizations who prepare their attacks in stealth for months. They lurk in networks and accounts for months as well. So for them, hacking is actually big business. We typically focus on the latter, so on those professionals who do the whale hunting, because if you protect yourself against those, by default, you will also protect and stop those more amateur-like attacks. When hackers actually choose their target, there's a couple of things that they do focus on. So they will focus on one hand, the wealth and the access of those people, which is typically something that is very publicly known. And then when they craft an attack for those targets, they will actually look for the path of least resistance. If you take a business owner as an example, the business itself will probably have quite some extensive security measures set in place. What we typically see is that the personal side is being unprotected. Their personal Gmail account. Think about your own Gmail account. You don't necessarily have additional security set in place for your email account. So we see that often once they have the target, they will look for that path of least resistance, which is often personal devices, personal accounts. But the path of least resistance can also be a person in your network. We, from that angle, often see grandparents, children, personal assistants. So people who might not be as tech savvy or as aware of what the risks are. And a good rule of thumb there is that the more of you that lives publicly online, the more exposure you have and the higher the probability that you will get targeted. And again, we have an example there of a very high-placed politician. So in this specific case, it's actually a former prime minister, and he had his personal email displayed on LinkedIn. And through a quick search of past data breaches and leaked passwords, it was clear that this individual was reusing the same password already for multiple years, always with all of the variations that we all do. There's a capital letter added, an exclamation mark, 123 at the end. And it was actually very easy to gain access to the personal mailbox. And then to add another layer to it, this individual actually used his personal laptop because he had a preference for brand. He didn't want to use a government laptop. So there was documents of nation state importance that this individual was receiving in on their personal device that the government was not monitoring, was not protecting, that was being forwarded to a personal Gmail account that was very easy to be breached. So it's an example of they look for the path of least resistance and they use personal information that they could potentially get their hands on.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It definitely gives me a moment of pause to just say, obviously, I'm not a prime minister, but you know, I think it's just important for us all to realize how at risk any of us can be. It's not just them; it's all of us who can be at risk. And when I read about cyber crimes, you know, I read about spear phishing and smishing and spoofing. You've talked a lot about social engineering. What kinds of attacks are most common when it comes to exploiting the vulnerabilities of a wealthy household or even a family office that they might have?
There's three I would like to highlight that we often see. So the first one is indeed social engineering. The second one is spear phishing. And then the third one is ransomware attacks. So I will double click on each of them because they're very, in terms of lingo, very cybersecurity focused. Social engineering attack is actually a very broad umbrella term that we use to describe an attack that tries to manipulate people and that tries to trick them into revealing information, doing something. So the doing something is often, for example, making a wire transfer or making a mistake. And we often see that within social engineering, trust, fear, and urgency, a combination of those three, one of those three, is very often used. So both studies and what we see show that more than 70% of the attacks actually start with social engineering. So an example of what we often see is the deepfake voice calls. So we often see the example of the grandparent receiving a deepfake voice call from a family member claiming that they are held in a place, that they need a deposit of X thousands of dollars. So that's something that we often see. A second one is spear phishing. So spear phishing is a type of social engineering attack. The specificity of spear phishing is that email is very often used here as a channel to make you do something. So the example that everybody knows is you receive an email from, between quotations, your bank asking you for account details. So email is something that we see is very popular as a channel because it's one, something that almost everybody has. And secondly, it is an account or it's a channel that accumulates a lot of data. So you receive notifications from your social media there, from your bank there, potential magazines that you subscribe to. So it's actually a wealth of information that all comes together at this one place. And an example there of what we saw was an investor who was fundraising for $50 million and at some point received an email from a trusted person, a trusted investor that she had been communicating for already for years. So she received an email from the email address that she had already been talking to for years. And the investor said, hey, this is actually a super interesting proposal that I want you to have a look at. I know you're fundraising at the moment, but once you have all the funds, could be an interesting opportunity to invest in. What turned out later was that the email of the so-called investor was actually hacked. So it was a fake email and that person had been locked out of their email account and very targeted spear phishing emails were sent to multiple partners of venture capitalist funds, private equity funds, very targeted and tailored to were they fundraising, were they investing. And then the last one is ransomware attacks. So a ransomware attack is when some data, and that could be personal data, that could be business data, is being stolen. So in our world, we call that being encrypted, and that they tell you, you will not have access to this data unless you do a payment of this specific sum. And then they will give you a virtual key to decrypt the data and you have access again to the data. So we see that happening a lot as well. The danger with those types of attacks is that you have zero certainty if you make the payment that you will actually get a decryption key. And then even if you receive that data back, you don't know if that data might have been leaked already on the dark web. So those three we see a lot, and those are three that we urge the families, family offices, investment space, the high stakes environment to be cautious for.
Are there warning signs that any of our listeners may need to pay attention to that would help alert them that they may be like a live target right now?
There are definitely some warning signs to kind of put your feelers out for. The first one is any alerts that you might receive concerning very specific accounts. So for example, if you start receiving emails that you don't expect about login attempts that you did not trigger or from locations that you do not know, that's something that should put your guards up. It typically means that somebody is trying to access an account. That could be a social media account. It could be your Instagram. It could be your email account. Another one is if you receive mails that notify you that there are new devices being added to an account. That's actually a recent one, is emails where they notify you that the security settings are being changed. So we recently had an example of, it was a European individual in this case, because it was about, or it concerned his WhatsApp, which is something that is an application that is very often used in Europe. And he received an email that multi-factor authentication was being turned off. So he was in the preparation of his WhatsApp account being taken over. So if you receive calls or messages from lawyers, tech support, banks, accountants asking for sensitive information, typically they will use dedicated platforms for that. So for example, any government related information, typically you will have to do that on an online government related platform. It's very atypical that they will ask you over phone,
right,
to give you any of those informations. And then any weird online activity that you see. So whether it is your internet searches that suddenly become a whole lot slower, it might indicate that there is some malware on your computer, or friends saying that they're receiving strange messages from you. I would say those are all some pointers for you to keep an eye out for?
I'm going to shift for a moment. Artificial intelligence is in the news really every day. I'm assuming that the hackers are beginning to take advantage of this particular technology. What are you seeing? How are they using AI? Can you give us some insight into how, in your world as a security professional, you're thinking about using and or are using AI?
Absolutely. AI is everywhere, I would say, in every industry, in every person's life, in some shape or form. Sadly enough, also on the side of the bad actors. So we see AI being leveraged very often for the social engineering attacks. So a big story, I think, that maybe some people already know was in 2024, where there was a Hong Kong-based financial worker who did a 25 million wire transfer after having a deepfake call with the, between quotations, CFO of the company. And that's actually a tactic that we see increasingly being used in attacks, where you have an actual person that is being put in a situation that could be, for example, a video call where they are interacting with multiple deepfakes. So it's not just one deepfake, it's multiple ones.
Will you explain what a deepfake is? In case someone hasn't heard that term, what is that?
A deepfake is actually an where they will try to fake as if an actual person. So that could be either in voice material, that could be in video material, but they will actually impersonate as an individual, but it's a complete digital copy of that person.
Okay. All right. I know I interrupted you there. Hopefully folks understand what a deepfake is, but what you're saying is that you're seeing more sophistication around the creation of these deepfakes.
Yes, indeed. They're becoming more and more credible. And we see now often that in situation, you have multiple deepfakes who, for example, will sit in a video call. They will talk with each other. And what that will lead to is that it actually increases the pressure on the actual individual, the actual person to do it, or to might not speak out of this is weird because they're all talking about, for example, a 25 million wire transfer that I don't know anything about, but they're all talking about it amongst each other. So it must be real. It only increases the credibility of and the chances of you carrying actually out that action. On our side, we also try to leverage AI to the best of our abilities and leveraging it for good. So we mostly use it to process data a whole lot faster. So if you think about us protecting your online life, there's a lot of data that comes with it. So AI enables us to go through that data a lot faster. It helps us to spot more complex patterns. And it helps us as well to spot, for example, behavioral anomalies. So if a person sometimes starts acting differently online than how they did before, it can help us trigger an alarm bell faster. And maybe it's a bit of a boring opinion or an atypical opinion, but if you do your security properly, I would dare to say that you shouldn't worry too much about AI threats. AI is or can be a very big threat for big organizations. But if you're in a family context or in a person-to-person context, doing human checks is actually very efficient against AI. So for example, in a family context, having a safe word. If you do receive suddenly a weird call from a nephew, a daughter, a grandparent asking you to do something, ask for a safe word. Of course, first, make sure that you agree on a safe word, but ask for a safe word or recontact people through another channel. If they, for example, called you through Messenger, tell them that you will call them back on their fixed line, something like that. Because if it is a deep fake, if it is AI, those human checks will actually get you very far.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So for all of the technology solutions, the good old basics there. Charlotte, you've definitely told us a lot about cyber criminals and also a bit about ourselves in our discussion so far. Next, I want to talk about specific action steps we can take to avoid becoming a cyber crime victim. Charlotte, let's spend a few minutes talking about specific ways we can defend ourselves from cyber attacks. We all want to be as safe as possible online, So what should we do? We all have different ways that we're potentially vulnerable. Can you suggest some high priority action steps that could apply to anyone?
Absolutely. There's a bunch that I could give you, but I'm going to keep it short and sweet to indeed some that everybody can apply in their day-to-day lives. So the first one is Google yourself. Know what your digital footprint is and know what lives of you online. And when I say Google yourself, I would say click beyond that first page, look at that second and third page. We recently had an example of a board member who still had her CV up on her previous employer site with a phone number, with an email address on there. So know what the digital footprint is. And if you bump into accounts or personal information that you're no longer using or that shouldn't be online, delete it. It can only be used against you. So I would say that's a very big one. Second one is maybe, again, a bit of a boring answer. It's one that we all know, but enable multi-factor authentication. So we typically abbreviate it with MFA. It's at least the default setting for your bank account. You don't mind when you access your accounts to an extra authentication. So why would you not do it for the rest of your accounts, whether that's social media or Telegram or WhatsApp that you use? Another one that is applicable for everybody is use Password Manager, because they will help you automatically use strong passwords. It will save it as well automatically, so you won't have the hassle of having to memorize them. And all of those steps are, I would say, applicable to individuals, but also repeat those steps with your entourage and with your family. Ask your family members as well to do that, or even your personal assistant, if you're a celebrity or a music artist, your tour manager. And a final one for the family context is have a discussion with your family. There are some very basic security questions that you can discuss and that you can agree on. So one of the questions that I do want to share here that you could have with your family is sit around the table and talk about, is there specific personal information that is off limits to share online? So for example, is everybody okay with sharing vacation pictures online and tagging people in those? And if you agree with everybody on this information is okay and this information is off limits, it helps establish kind of a baseline for everybody.
And then I'm going to issue a callback, maybe a fifth item, and that is your safe word recommendation. That sounds like something that, especially if you have teenagers, young adults in the household, it could be really important to make sure you've got that safe word defined as well. On the password front, it plagues all of us in some way, and it's gotten better in the last year. I think some of the tools that have rolled out from various providers have made it easier. Are there any other helpful hints or guidance that you would give us to make that a better experience for everyone?
We try to work passwordless wherever we can, because it actually reduces the risk of them trying to steal your password or phishing attacks. And some examples of passwordless authentication is, for example, using your biometrics. So if you have a phone, a lot of people have it enabled that with Face ID, it automatically unlocks. So that's an example of passwordless. Your fingerprint is another example of biometrics that you can use. The one-time passcodes as well. Those are all authentication ways or safe ways to log in that don't require you to have a password. So we do hope that there is a world where we can go passwordless, but until we do use passwords, use a password manager, and multi-factor authentication really is the new minimum standard.
Are there other defensive measures that are particularly important for high net worth individuals that you'd like to draw their attention to?
Well, if you have a small team, you might have an assistant or a family officer or an investor working for and with you, think about extending protective measures as well to them. And I know it might be a bit unfair, but your IT and your security actually should be at the same standards as if you would be a medium-sized company. And in your search of getting that protection, look for parties, look for individuals who are used to working to contexts that are very similar to yours. So whether that's a wealth context, whether that's an investment context, whether that's a small team context. So I recently actually spoke with an individual who is forming a family with sport athletes. And they were conducting an audit, as they called it. So they were actually making a list of what are all of the devices that they have within the family, which accounts hold the most important information, whether that's email accounts, are there specific OneDrive places or cloud storages where the will might be documented. So they were doing that full audit of kind of mapping out the crucial places and thinking as a family of, do we need to have some additional security measures for those specific spaces and places? So I would say try to protect yourself with solutions and technology and people who are used to working to your specific environment.
And if you've mentioned this before in our discussion, if your day-to-day involves a bit of an entourage, so if you have a personal assistant, if you have a family office manager, if there's maybe a family foundation staff as well, it's just really critical that the entire circle, if you will, is aware of this digital hygiene that, again, hackers are going to find the place of least resistance. So it's very important that you create a chain that basically is equally strong throughout. Charlotte, thank you so much for giving us so many great ways to protect ourselves. This has been a truly informative discussion. I've got a whole list of to-dos. I think I'm going to start by mapping out my digital files, if you will, and the email addresses, because our family has multiple places where we're showing up and where we have documents. So I'm thinking of the digital audit for our family, and that's a step that I can take in response to what I've learned from you today. Next, let's wrap up this discussion about cyber attacks and defenses with some final thoughts. Charlotte, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and helping us understand both the risk we all face online and what we can do to protect ourselves. Before you go, we have a tradition of asking all of our guests, what's the one thing that they've been meaning to do that they haven't done yet and that they're willing to commit to do now, kind of in front of all of our listeners? So with that, do you have an I've been meaning to do that item?
I do. I absolutely do. And it's actually very daunting to commit to. But here goes. So I looked an hour before this at my phone, and I actually have 46,000 items in my photo gallery on my phone. So I will commit to cleaning up my photo gallery on my mobile devices. I will scroll through all 46,000 because nobody needs 27 identical pictures of their cat. The reason why is because one, where there's actually malware that focuses on stealing pictures from your photo library, because we've all taken pictures of driver licenses, passwords, all of that. But then more on the personal side, I think cleaning and going through all those pictures will make me, or will give me a moment to reminisce over the past years. So that's what I'm committing to do.
Well, thank you again, Charlotte, for taking the time to join me for this really important conversation.
Thank you very much. It was a pleasure.
And I want to thank you all for listening today. If you like this episode, please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast, and tell friends and family about it. If you have a question for me or a suggestion for this podcast, email me at dothat@truist.com. I'll be back soon for another episode of I've Been Meaning to Do That, the podcast that gets you moving toward fulfilling your purpose and achieving your financial goals. Talk to you soon.
Oscar Lynn Elder is an investment advisor representative, Truist Advisory Services, Incorporated. Any comments or references to taxes herein are informational only. Truist and its representatives do not provide tax or legal advice. You should consult your individual tax or legal professional before taking any action that may have tax or legal consequences. CyberWolf is an independent third-party service provider and is not affiliated with Truist Financial Corporation, TFC, nor any of its subsidiaries or affiliates. TFC teammates may refer clients to CyberWolf However, TFC makes no representation as to the qualities, effectiveness, and/or terms and conditions of any services provided by CyberWolf, and TFC clients are responsible for conducting their own due diligence regarding CyberWolf services. Neither TFC nor its employees receive compensation in connection with client referrals to CyberWolf.